Hello and welcome to the Eurocopa podcast. I'm your host, Nipun Chopra. Thanks for joining us again. Tonight, we'll be updating you on the status of the now concluded group stages of Copa America Centenario, as well as discussing the first round of games of the European Championships. In order to discuss these topics, I'm joined by co-hosts and friends, Karthik Krishnayar and Gabe Smith. Thanks for joining me, gentlemen. Let's get into it, guys. Let's talk about Group A, the group that we all have a vested interest in, because the U.S. men's national team actually ended up winning this group with 6 points. Colombia also had six, and then Costa Rica with four, and Paraguay with the 1 point. So, guys, we have to talk about the U.S. men's national team. The last time the three of us were together recording a podcast, it was after the U.S. had just lost to Colombia, and we were all tearing Jurgen Klinsmann a new one. But now we're at the stage that the U.S. has actually won the group. And let's talk about those two performances. Gabe, the first performance actually came against Costa Rica, a very good offensive performance, 4-0 win, and it could have been more than that. And as you and I talked about after the Costa Rica game, it was on the back of absolutely no changes made with the starting lineup that lost to Colombia. Absolutely no changes made with the formations as well. So how do you contextualize that performance?
Well, you know, I think there's certainly you can focus on the way that you know, the dynamic that needed to shift, you know, in the players' mentality and attitude going from, you know, an opening match to where they knew that their Copa America, you know, hopes and dreams here and doing anything in this tournament, we're going to ride then on that match. So I think that was certainly a big case going into the second match then against Costa Rica. I think, you know, the other thing to it, even though, you know, Colombia didn't necessarily play its best game, we're obviously talking about Colombia, you know, one of the better teams here in the world, certainly in this tournament. And so kind of a pedantic display then that was put forth against Colombia maybe shouldn't have been read in as the doomsday, you know, type kind of scenarios that I think a lot of soccer pundits everywhere, us included, you know, we're starting to cast then in terms of that performance. So I think it certainly has, you had to measure both of those elements going into it. But overall, I think, you know, more than anything, I'm just very satisfied then with the players' resolve and their mentality through it, because there certainly was not only just their backs against the wall, again, from facing elimination, but I think just the perspective and the attitude from American fans there at that point was almost kind of to the tipping point. And I think that they have slowly kind of brought back the fans back into the fold, and there's some renewed confidence going into, you know, a pretty big quarterfinal matchup.
Karthik, what Gabe talks about, the resolve really came into play in the game against Paraguay, because the U.S. came into the game needing just a point to pretty much guarantee going through. And as it played out, they were a man down and defended with 10 men for about 43 to 44 minutes. And that, in a way, was as impressive as the 4-0 win. But I know you're going to have a counterpoint, so I'm ready for it.
Well, actually, I don't have a counterpoint. In fact, I think what we saw was a mature tactical decision by Klinsmann to pull Clint Dempsey off, a decision I thought was a bad decision after Yedlin's consecutive rash challenges. For those who didn't realize this, I think that's the quickest back-to-back sending off. We're celebrating the 100 years of Copa America. That's the quickest consecutive yellows in Copa America history, or at least records of this sort have been kept. So there was about 40 seconds between the two yellow cards, and I think 7 seconds of actual play between the two yellow cards. So Klinsmann is put in this tough position. You're up 1-0. You're playing a dangerous Paraguay team. What he did is he pulled off Clint Dempsey in order to bring Michael Orozco, a defender, on. The thinking was you should pull off Bedoya or pull off Wood or pull off Zardes, one of those three. What in fact ended up happening is by pulling off Dempsey, he is maybe one guy who can hold the ball and dribble at people, but you gave yourself the option to play an outlet ball to a Bobby Wood, who's a player who's big, not necessarily big and strong, like Jozy Altidore, but still an outlet ball, a guy who can hold the ball up, and is quick enough to where you can play the ball over into space and he can run onto it. Zardes was running the channels very well again in that game. So that's another potential outlet ball. And then Bedoya could come back and help with the defensive work in front of Michael Orozco, who is not a natural right back. It ended up being a very, very good tactical move given the circumstance that Klinsmann was put in. And I think he gets high marks for that, as do the U.S. for seeing out the game. I know we're going to have to talk about the future for the U.S., the next match, and not having Yedlin, I think, is a very big deal when we talk about Ecuador. But job well done in the group. The U.S. Certainly, I should say, this is the best. I would take the first 30 minutes of the Costa Rica game out of it. I think Costa Rica were the better team for the first 30 minutes against the U.S. and were unfortunate to find themselves down a goal at that point. This is the best 150 minutes the U.S. has played consecutively in competitive matches under Jurgen Klinsmann, including World Cup qualifiers at home. So because you never play two World Cup qualifiers in a row at home, right? Yeah. So this is the best 150 minutes consecutively of competitive play, probably since Spain, the end of the Egypt game, the entire game against Spain, that monumental win in 2009 at the Confederations Cup, and the first half against Brazil. So this is a pretty high watermark in recent U.S. soccer history, 7 years.
But then, Karthik, let me stick with you with this, because we've been very critical of Klinsmann and all of us on the podcast in some way or the other. But now we're at the point that if he actually beats Ecuador, which, I mean, U.S. is 60-40 favorites to beat Ecuador. That's what I would say. If he does that, he's actually achieved his goal of reaching the semifinal. So where does Klinsmann stand in your eyes right now?
We're in the middle of a tournament, so it's tough to assess, but this is a major tournament. This is the biggest tournament the U.S. has played in outside of World Cups in its history, really, other than the 95 Copa America down in Uruguay. I'm sorry, the Confederations Cup, it was great to beat Spain, but it's the Confederations Cup. It's kind of a throwaway tournament. And the Gold Cup, to me, is just if you don't win it, then you've done something wrong. And the U.S. didn't win it, so they did something wrong last year. If you get to the semifinals of this tournament, as badly as it started, I think it speaks to Klinsmann kind of maturing instead of tinkering. You know, he's a tinkerer, right? Mm-hmm. Because he always has to harder than us. I've talked about this before countless times on this show, where he'll tinker, he'll give these formation wrinkles because he wants to show he's smarter than us, and he actually does get tactics, even though everybody has said that Jurgi Love did the tactics in Germany, and Philipp Lahm said we couldn't figure it out at Bayern, we didn't have a coaching staff, we had to figure it out on the pitch. So he's had this reputation, so he's tried to push back against us by proving he's smarter than we are. This is the first time he's been mature enough to realize, okay, I have 11 really good, a core 11 that's really good, and then a couple of guys off the bench in Pulisic and Nagby and Graham Zusi that are playing at a very high level that we can incorporate. I don't need to mix and match like he did even in the World Cup. The U.S. had, by most standards, a successful World Cup considering the group they were in. But he kept changing the lineup in the World Cup, right? And he started Brad Davis on the left side, you know, one of the slowest left-sided players in MLS. He started against Germany. So think about that. When the U.S. was on 4 points and was leading the group, had an opportunity to win the group. So he's a tinkerer. This tournament, he's been very mature. He's left well enough alone. I think I was on another show discussing the U.S. men's national team earlier today, and I said, if you look at our player pool, this is the best our player pool has been since entering the 2006 World Cup. And again, we were entering the 2006 World Cup with an injured, with a rundown Claudio Reyna, who had a lot of injury problems the previous year at Manchester City, previous season, and John O'Brien, who was at the end of his career, and he never played another match of competitive soccer after the World Cup. So if you could factor in the injuries of those two guys, this is the best team we've had since 2003 or 2004, the very early stages of qualifying for that World Cup. So he should be doing well, but he is doing well. And which means we'll have to take a step back after this tournament and assess it. But hey, you know, you're judged at the international level, you're judged by tournament football. And you see coaches who come in after great qualifying runs who get the sack after three games. Wirt van Marwijk comes to mind, the Dutch in Euro 2012, because things blow up in a tournament. The U.S. might have caught lightning in the bottle and caught fire, which is defies all the form guides for the last 2 years of how they played in this tournament. But it's tournament football, and he's going to get rewarded for that.
And now, if I can jump in real quick, I agree with everything that Kartik just said there. But that all said, I do think, though, that this won't necessarily quell some of the biggest anti-Klinsmann that population that's out there, because I can just see it already in terms of the narrative is still going to be, well, you know, looking at this, you know, Colombia more kind of lost its first place seeding rather than USA winning it. And that, you know, you have then to where looking at the actual matchups there in terms of the biggest team that USA has faced in this tournament being Colombia, lost 2-0, and that, you know, we'll see what happens here against Ecuador. But it's, you know, it may not be until then, you know, semifinal that you have in another big South American type opponent. You know, we'll see how they fare with that. So I agree with what Kartik, and I think that people need to reassess and take, you know, kind of a big picture look at that. But I know that just in terms of the way that this 24/7 kind of sports cycle and really, you know, taking maybe facts and elements then and really kind of converting into your own narrative there, that this won't do anything to necessarily silence then his bit of critics out there.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. And I think that touches on to something that I've been thinking a lot about, which is the reaction, you know, the immediate reaction of these games and how one result here and there basically completely changed the analysis.
Yeah.
After the first loss against Colombia, Jurgen Klinsmann's job was on fire, on the line. The win against Costa Rica kind of quelled that. And then the win against Paraguay suddenly changed.
Yeah, the narrative completely changed. I agree with everything Gabe said, and I'll go a step further. Sunil Gulati, for the first time in Klinsmann's tenure, publicly addressed that entering the Costa Rica game because the Colombia game had been such a disappointment, and said, "Yeah, this is a important tournament. Everything is on the table if we fail in that." I'm paraphrasing, but that's basically what he said. And since then, the team has been playing lights out.
Good
it's very, very odd, or maybe there's a direct correlation. I don't know.
Yeah, basically what you're saying is Sunil Gulati is the reason the U.S. men's national team is doing well. All right, I got it.
send the thank you cards now.
Send thank you cards to Sunil Gulati. Gentlemen, before we switch to talking about Group B, let me tell you about our sponsor, SeatGeek. So the big problem that I always have with these places we buy tickets from is that when I go to the checkout line, the checkout page, there's always a huge fee added on, whether it's like $10 fee for picking your nose or $20 fee for waiting in line on the internet for 30 minutes, whatever it is, they randomly make up a fee and you have to pay that. So there's actually a big difference in the price you're quoted and the price that you actually end up paying. With SeatGeek, that's actually not the case. With SeatGeek, every time you actually buy the ticket, that's the price you'll end up paying. And they put all the tickets available on other sites into one place. So you save time and never miss a deal. And you can even set alerts for upcoming events such as we know, the Copa Centenario or the International Champions Cup, which I know Gabe is going to go watch some Liverpool action in St. Louis. Was it St. Louis, Gabe?
Right. Yes, it is.
So how can you get these tickets? That's the next question. So what you have to do is, in order to get your $20 rebate on tickets, you download the free SeatGeek app on your phone. You go to the settings tab and click add a promo code. You enter promo code WSTPOD, and then SeatGeek will send you $20 after you've made your first ticket purchase. So in order to get your $20 rebate off of your SeatGeek purchase, make sure you follow those steps and download the free SeatGeek app. Enter promo code WSTPOD today. Gentlemen, back to soccer. Group B. How do I start? Peru wins this group. When we were doing previews, we knew Haiti would probably be whipping boys a little bit, but I think all of us definitely picked Peru to finish third in this group. They end up winning the group. Ecuador comes second with 5 points. Haiti finishes with 0, and Brazil ends up with 4 points, ends up going out. And that's where we will start this conversation, Gabe. The big talking point in this entire group is the capitulation of Brazil. When we did previews, we noted some of the problems this team had. We noted the lack of strikers. We noted that they were missing one of the better defenders in the world. We noted the problems within the team with Dunga in some cases. But then we also noted the likes of Coutinho, Willian, players who on their day can absolutely turn a game. So how did this awful, awful thing happen when we saw some of those flashes in the second game where they won 7-1, I think it was?
Yeah, I think it's interesting when you look at this. I think this kind of shows every bit of the highs and lows that Brazil's gone through. I think we'll obviously maybe chat a little bit about in terms of Haiti. That obviously seems like in terms of that scoreline now, just a one-off, a blip on the radar. There when you look at then their performances, against Ecuador and Peru. I think that the biggest thing with Brazil is that they're really with the inconsistencies, the change in manager staff now, it's almost happening every 2 years. They're really lacking an identity. They're really lacking a presence. It was interesting into this tournament. You could say that there was going to be already a tough situation to come out of this then doing well with such a priority and focus towards in the Olympics, since that was going to be played in Brazil. I think it's unfair to say that this was Brazil's B squad per se, but it certainly was a much younger squad, full of some players than that much of the international community has never become acquainted with, unless they're following then the Brazil domestic league then quite routinely. And you had some opportunities. I think you had some players that took some of the opportunities there that were given. Gabriel Barbosa, Gabigol then played well in his appearances there. Maybe not so much then against Peru, but there were certainly moments I think can be built upon. Philippe Coutinho had definitely a great game there against Haiti. Overall, throughout the course of the tournament, I think he still was one of Brazil's best players, especially from an attacking sense there. But you get back to, I think, the decision-making and the personnel that Dunga carries out. I mean, it's always been one of the biggest, I think, critiques then. His player selection, his tactics, and his choices there. I mean, this was something that goes back even as far as 2010 when he had his first stint there with Brazil. And looking at the World Cup performance, while it wasn't necessarily up to the par of obviously Brazil standards, where Brazil had been, it was something at least to kind of build upon. But even at that point, you still had some of Brazil's there, some of its best players, even players like Pelé, that were questioning then his the players that he brought to that particular tournament, and again the style of the play. So I think that's always been kind of hanging over. I think it's definitely something to where looking at the reaction with now Dunga being ousted as manager, for a good majority he was never really the manager that they wanted. Again, more of the fans, not necessarily the Brazil than organization behind the scenes there. So I think, coming from this tournament, I think some of the fans are going to be looking forward to the future, obviously looking towards the Olympics. But you have to say one of the biggest disappointments coming from Copa America is that obviously the fact that Brazil couldn't even get past the group stage there.
Right. And Karthik, we know that Dunga has lost his job. And in some ways, he's lost his job to this idea of the Brazilian team that Brazilians have. They have this, and the world stage actually, all of us have, this idea that this Brazil team exists, that the likes of players like Ronaldo and Romario and Zico and Socrates and all those players who we, those names roll off our tongues. Rivaldo is the one I forgot. So, however, that idea of the Brazil shirt has weighed heavy on this team that didn't have those players. And Dunga in some ways has lost his job because of the expectations of that Brazil team. So talk to me about the difference in reality of Brazil versus the idea of that Brazil shirt.
Well, that Brazil shirt's a very pertinent thing. I was in Orlando covering the Brazil-Haiti game, the game where Brazil scored 7 goals last week. Philippe Coutinho had this brilliant game playing kind of in a deep-lying playmaker position and running at guys. And Dunga had put him there purposely, to give him more space, more time on the ball, more ability to be creative. And a lot of the Haitian supporters and Haitian journalists were saying after the game, we're in awe of the shirt because This is why we played so poorly. And I've known this for years about the Haitian relationship, the Haitian fan relationship with Brazil. That's Haiti hasn't qualified for a World Cup since 1974. That's they typically root for Brazil in international tournaments, and Haiti doesn't always even qualify for Gold Cups, right? They qualify, they're hit or miss. They qualify for one Gold Cup, miss the next one. It kind of goes like that. So there's this awe of the Brazil shirt in Haiti, but South American teams. Ecuador, Peru, and the teams that Brazil's playing in qualifying right now, they're right outside automatic qualification spot. They would end up in a playoff. They're not in awe of the Brazil shirt anymore. Brazil's like any other South American country. The level of football and calm the ball is so good. The level of tactical coaching from Argentine managers who have spread out across the continent managing. Look at just the impact of Argentine managers. Peru, Argentine manager. Paraguay, he's just resigned, but Argentine manager. Chile, we've talked about the two Argentine managers, Sampoli and Bielsa, and what they've done. Jose Peckerman, Colombia, Argentine manager. And they've all figured out how to play Brazil and beat Brazil. Every single one of them.
Right.
So that shirt doesn't awe anyone anymore. It still awes people in Brazil. They have that level of expectation, but it's like the 1980s and early 1990s in baseball in the United States when the New York Yankees had fallen off. The pinstripes of the Yankees are similar to the yellow of Brazil. I think the level of expectation for Brazil is out of whack. They have one great player, right? Maybe they have two great players. One who is Neymar, who skipped this tournament. The other is Thiago Silva, who can't get along with Dunga and has been out of the team now for about 2 years. You take those two guys out, you hear constantly, and we're going to get to the Euros in a few minutes and talk about Portugal drawing Iceland. You hear, well, if you take Cristiano Ronaldo out of Portugal, they have some nice players at big clubs, but they're just like any other European side. You take Neymar and Thiago Silva out of Brazil, it's not like it was when those names that rolled off the tongue, the Zicos and the Socrates and the Rivaldos played for Brazil. You take Neymar and Thiago Silva out of the team, they're not only like any other South American team, they're arguably inferior to Chile and to Colombia and Ecuador and certainly to Argentina. So I think the level of expectation is out of whack, and Brazil has to come to grips with the reality, which is that they are – and this is the case also as the three of us cover European club football – that Brazil is even losing its aura as a great manufacturer of players in South America. I think most clubs in England would prefer to sign Argentine players. They think they're better professionals. They're probably more technical than Brazilian players. We've never been at a stage like we are right now with Brazil.
Yeah, good point. And I would argue, just to add on top of that before we move to Group C, is that when I think back to the 2002 World Cup winning side, there were excellent players in that team in the forward positions, but they had a better goalkeeper and they had a better central midfield. I know Fernandinho has done somewhat of a good job, but honestly, I can't even think of a player like Kleberson. So Kleberson is a player that three of us know from NASL who, as Sir Alex put it, and a lot of people in Brazil put it, Tim Vickery put it, basically catapulted them to the World Cup. And Chris Henage always has this saying that I love, that they're either too many piano carriers or too many piano players. And I think Brazil is having the same problem Belgium is, that they're too many piano players.
I was going to ask if you're talking about Belgium or Brazil.
Yeah, both of them. They both need a few piano carriers, because those are the players that win you these championships, I think. All right, gentlemen, let's move ahead to Group C. Mexico wins this group. I think we all knew Mexico would qualify. I think all of us picked them to qualify second. Venezuela comes second, both of them even on 7 points. Uruguay, out of the group, 3 points. Jamaica, whipping boys in this group. So let's. I'd like to start with Uruguay first. Gabe, where do we start with this Uruguay team? So obviously your beloved Luis Suarez didn't play a minute because of that hamstring injury he incurred before the tournament. But what disappointed me was, outside of Godin, you can point your finger at multiple players in this team who did not live up to the expectation we had of them, whether that was in defensive positions, whether that was in central midfield with the likes of Arvelo Rios, or in the forward positions, which, of course, we are all thinking of Edison Cavani.
Yeah, Yeah, it really was. I mean, you started off with Godin. I mean, him and Jimenez. You know, I mean, talk about in terms of you have a center back pairing, playing for club and country here. That you know, in terms of really should be knowing exactly where each other need to be, positioning there. Now, I obviously in the grand scheme of things, the defense wasn't necessarily the biggest issue. There, but I was quite taken back by it. Did not seem like they were on the same page at times. I think overall, you know, Uruguay lost this in midfield. There just didn't seem to be, you know, enough presence there in the midfield, enough stability. Whether it was in terms of being able to eliminate the counterattack, then that they were facing at times, especially against then Venezuela. If it wasn't then looking at in terms of being able to connect and be able to hold in the ball. And be able to feed then Cavani up top, and of course then we look at Edison Cavani. You know that game then against Venezuela was shocking there towards the end, especially the missed chances that were there. I was completely blown away by. I just did not see Cavani missing some of those opportunities there towards the end, and you really didn't have, I think, then that kind of player that was stepping through, someone then who was going to be able to take then Suarez's absence and really make it an opportunity for them to step up and you know have you know the opportunity for in the future you know inserting themselves and making it a tougher question than for the manager. And I was kind of looking at maybe it might be either a Gaston Ramirez or an Abel Hernandez, one of those two, even though Hernandez got a goal there, but a very inconsequential game there against Jamaica, obviously, as both teams were eliminated in that third leg, that third match. I just didn't really see that at any point in time. And you know, you have to say that we were talking about in terms of Brazil, you know, and being a big disappointment. I certainly put Uruguay much higher. I mean, the expectations, you know, historically overall, Brazil, you know, carries, you know, a bigger stick. But right now, at the current point, Uruguay right now is leading, you know, all South American teams then in World Cup qualifications. And they've been able to do that thus far, obviously, with the whole entire Luis Suarez then suspension. So this expectation of Suarez coming back, really lifting the squad, that this could be, you know, a team then to really look out for, you know, leading up to then the World Cup in 2018. And of course, now it's completely changed, you know, and now the questions become what in the world went wrong. And I think there's a multitude of factors. And obviously, you're going to have some of the focus, too, in terms of Suarez and the outburst that took place there, you know, in the second leg against Venezuela when it appeared that he wasn't even told in terms of not being on the list. I mean, it became then almost just a comedy at that time. And so any way you look at it, whether it be on the pitch or off the pitch, Uruguay put forth quite an embarrassing performance.
This having been all said, and I agree with everything Gabe has said, I will point out, because they're top of the South American qualifying, because they're Uruguay, and we know they didn't have Luis Suarez fit in this tournament, Tabárez is a legend. He's a great coach. There's no threat. It's only an issue if you're not doing well in qualifying. People asked about this awkward Copa year. How was it going to? How were South American countries going to judge themselves? And I said prior to the tournament, well, if they're doing really well in World Cup qualifying, like Ecuador and Uruguay are, it may not matter that much to them. If they're Brazil or they're one of the countries at the bottom who are struggling, it could give them a boost. Well, we saw how Brazil reacted. They're not doing well in qualifying, and so they felt like they needed to at least contend to win this tournament. I mean, not get knocked out at the group stage, and Dunga lasted about 24 hours after they were eliminated. So it was a big deal for them. For Uruguay, they want to win Copas. They've won more Copas, South American Championships / Copas, than any other nation, but I don't think it's a huge deal, honestly, because I think they're fine, and they will have Luis Suarez back in qualifying, and he's one of the five best players on the planet, and they don't have a reason for players to be checked out. I mean, Dunga, as I say again, because he had alienated Thiago Silva, they were always at a disadvantage. Mm-hmm. They don't have that many great players, and so they've been playing with a hand behind their back, basically, for two years now.
Karthik, I want to talk to you about Mexico, but I really quickly want to say something about Venezuela, because one of the most common pieces of feedback we got about the when we were doing the dailies was mostly your ability to place teams in a socio-political context and how much people enjoyed learning about that. So one of the teams we didn't really talk about in the background was Venezuela. And the reason I bring this up is just today I was listening to an NPR podcast with Fresh Air with Terry Gross, and she interviewed this gentleman who lived in Venezuela, and he was talking about how much poverty there is now and how many financial problems Venezuela is having, in the sense that a lot of the country is having to ration its electricity. So I was thinking about this because there are these people who probably miss some of this game, some of these games, but Venezuela has done so well in this group, and it will lift. And that's why we love this game. It lifts people. And
quick on that, Ali Moreno from ESPN, who, of course, Venezuelan international, 40-plus caps. He played his entire professional career, club career in Major League Soccer. So American fans know him well. 11 seasons as a professional, all 11 were in the U.S. We're in MLS. He said that this is incredible because of that, exactly what you pointed out. A lot of the protests against the Maduro government, a lot of the suffering, all of that is suspended temporarily, and the country right now is riding the wave. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the wave might end real subside real soon. They're going to play Argentina in the next round. If they held on against Mexico, they would have gotten a weaker opponent, but it's still pretty amazing, and it's something that has the country in a kind of a frenzy for these couple of weeks, and putting aside their trouble. We know football and sport can do this, and all too often we're going to talk about the problems with the Euros in a little bit. It does the opposite, but this is really a feel-good thing, kind of the opposite of what we've seen at the Euros, as I said.
Karthik, a country that will be buzzing is Mexico right now. They have had three very good games. And are credit to themselves with not only their style of football, but the structure they have created in that team. And a lot of the reservations you and I had, especially in terms of Marquez's role in that team, beyond his leadership, his positional role, have been answered, at least in these three games. So what did you see of this Mexico team that has allowed them to win what was a very difficult group?
They're tight at the back, and Osorio's team. So I covered MLS more closely than I do now, actually, when Osorio was managing an MLS. I think, actually, in those days, I was exclusively covering MLS, nothing else. And Osorio is very organized. His teams are very tactically sound at the back, which is why I wondered about what are they going to do. Torrado is no longer in the team. Congratulations, guys. Torrado is now a member of the 11 in NASL. Mm-hmm. Torrado was a theme of our preview pod, so right. I'm excited to see him in NASL. But he has slid Rafa Marquez into that Torrado role, and it's worked. And that's the kind of the linchpin, because if you look at even the teams he's managed at the club level, Osorio's got this incredible background. He began as an assistant here in Major League Soccer, went to Manchester City under Kevin Keegan, was an assistant on Keegan's staff for 3.5 seasons before returning to Colombia when Keegan stepped down and Stuart Pearce took over, returning to Colombia, managing Millonarios, then coming back to the United States, managing here for two MLS teams, then going to Mexico and managing, then going to Sao Paulo and managing. He's been able to take all that knowledge from managing both in England with Manchester City and then all these teams in the Americas, put it together and create a system that is tight and efficient, but also has some flair in it. And you see all these different influences on him. And I should point out he's Colombian, not Mexican. So it's Colombian with a lot of American in him because he spent a lot of time in the U.S.
Yeah.
It's a great pleasure to watch this team. The thing I worry about, though, I hate to bring this up, and this again, we're going to talk about these problems with the Euros later. Mexican fans are notoriously xenophobic, and they've got a Colombian coach with massive American influence, a guy who spent a lot more time in the United States than he has in Mexico in his life, actually educated in this country, speaks fluent English, obviously. I worry that if they don't win this tournament, because they've looked so good at the group stage, they look like the best team in this tournament besides Argentina, that because he's Colombian, the short knives begin to come out. Let's say they start to have a little wobble in qualifying because they've been They've ripped through qualifying, which is something Mexico never does. Mexico had they almost didn't qualify for the final round when Sven-Göran Eriksson was their manager, then kind of struggled even after Aguirre came in, and then we know last qualifier, they were just very fortunate to qualify. I worry that there's going to be a turnabout on him as the manager, but right now it looks very good, and I think we're headed for an Argentina-Mexico final in all likelihood in this tournament. Maybe the United States has something to say about that. Maybe Ecuador has something to say about that. Right. But I really don't see anyone else. Those four countries, and obviously U.S. and Ecuador play each other in the next round. So you're going to get
the winner will play Argentina almost certainly.
And the winner will play Argentina. It's wide open for Mexico. That's what I was about to say. They avoid all three of those other countries. I think they're going to be in the finals.
Gabe, with Group D, it's the only one that fell exactly how we all thought it would. Argentina's won the group pretty much, unless something crazy happens. Currently, Chile is beating Panama. Is beating Bolivia? Is it Bolivia or Panama they're playing?
No, Panama. They're beating Panama 2-1.
They're beating Panama, yep. So which will mean that they are they go through in second place. So this group has kind of fallen exactly how we predicted it would. So instead of going on about how good Argentina is, we'll save that for when we review them in the quarterfinals. Let's talk really about quickly about Chile and then move on to talking about the Euros. So, Gabe, Chile. Some of the same analysis that we had before the tournament started, with the likes of Vidal, the likes of Sanchez. Those are the players that we've focused on, and those are the players that have managed to deliver along with the likes of Vargas.
Yeah. I would say that at this point in time, it hasn't been as impressive a performance, by Chile for me. I think, certainly in terms of, you had the opening match against Argentina, certainly a tough opener to begin the tournament, having that. I really don't think that, and obviously that was a 2-1 loss to Argentina. I didn't think that they really, went full throttle there against Bolivia. I mean, we saw in terms of Argentina, which I certainly wouldn't say was ruthless at all, but you had then obviously a first half that they were able to impose themselves on it, but really wasn't until Messi coming on the second half there in a short pretty much 30-35 minute stint where we saw a hat trick that Argentina then
just
ended up with
just another day at the office
scoreline.
For Leo
yeah,
Messi.
Yeah, all I need is 30 minutes. I can get three goals in 30. No problems. Thanks. I just didn't really see that, in that same kind of presence. And obviously when Chile played Bolivia as well. So I haven't been too impressed. I do think that in terms of, going into the next round, then, going against Mexico, most likely again, if we are seeing then Chile as being the second seed in there, I do see Mexico getting past that, could make for at least an interesting then, semifinal matchup between, then Colombia. So, but overall, Chile, in terms of it, like I said, just hasn't really impressed me as much as I thought they would. Although I will say that that based on the performances thus far, I think that you really have to look at the squad there. It just didn't really see enough people kind of step up. I thought Vidal was great through this tournament. Vargas has got the two goals then so far against Panama in this match. Alexis Sanchez, I think sometimes my biggest question mark with him is when he does try to play almost in that kind of central striker role that just doesn't seem to necessarily call out some of his best qualities. And I think this might be something that Chile needs to overall kind of think about going into future tournaments. But, I say that now and probably, Chile is going to end up, running a riot and go away to the final now. So it's just my luck, I'm sure.
Karthik, let's move on to the European Championships. We have to start with the ugly part of all of this, and that's the fan violence. We know there was a huge issue during the England-Russia game, and recently as this afternoon, there was an ugly incident at a bar, or it was either a bar or a restaurant. I saw the video of Russian fans throwing chairs at English and Welsh fans, and English and Welsh fans yelling back at them, singing in unison, and police having to break everything up. So talk to me about this, Karthik. This is the ugly part of soccer. This is the part of soccer that we don't want to see. And a lot of us like to pretend, myself included, that we're kind of past this Green Street Hooligans type of experience in the soccer community. So why is this happening right now?
Well, I think we all thought we were past it. This is the 1980s again. Yeah. This is terrible. This is the worst this is the worst outbreak of violence around a major tournament, I think, since, well, actually probably even worse than Euro 88 when England was at the height of hooliganism after Heysel had been banned. English clubs had been banned from European competitions. England itself had not been banned. So England fans, Euro 88, were smashing things in Germany. And then it didn't help that they threw the Republic of Ireland in the first game and got beat right at the group stage. Mm-hmm. And that just furthered it. This is horrible, and people are in denial about what's going on. We can't be in denial. This is terrible. It is right now more important than the tournament and the football itself, unfortunately. They are not isolated incidents. It has gone on for 4 or 5 days now. Mm-hmm. People are now looking at the focal point of what happened in the stadium in Marseille, and then what happened immediately after with Steve Bauer, who is working for ESPN during this tournament. Obviously, we're used to him working for NBC during the Premier League. He's with ESPN during the tournament, was in Marseille that night and talked about how scary it was for him as a veteran English journalist who had covered some of these outbreaks of hooliganism before, which involved England fans in Euro 2000 and in World Cup 98 in the same city in Marseille when England played Tunisia, that this was much, much worse and much more serious and much scarier. This had actually kicked off 3 days earlier, and there are a couple factors here. The Russians, first of all, I can't remember if it was on our show or if it was on a Daniel Feuerstein show, but I do remember when the draw was made in December being concerned about England and Russia being in the same group, because there are rampant political implications. And Putin, as the leader of Russia, likes to point at the Americans and the British as the cause of all his problems, and has large segment of the Russian population who agree with that. And so playing against England is not like playing against France or Germany for them, or mm-hmm. Romania or Slovakia or whoever else. It's a big deal. So that gave the Russians an opportunity to politicize the event, which they clearly did. We have right-wing political leaders who have traveled to France. We have thugs that are, according to one or two of my sources, not even really speaking in Russian. These are the same people that were sent into Crimea, or the same types of people that were sent into Crimea to cause trouble, cause disorder in Ukrainian cities before the Russians, and in Georgian cities before the Russians sent the tanks in, or Russian-backed paramilitary went in. So the same sort of troublemakers. They're not football fans, but they've been sent to Marseille. On the other end, you've got kind of a volatile situation in England. The Brexit vote for Britain to leave the EU is in a few weeks. I think there is a majority of support within England to leave the EU. Now, of course, Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland are part of this vote. Scotland, there's strong opposition to leaving the European Union, could trigger another independence referendum for Scotland. We don't need to get into that now. If the UK as a whole votes to leave. There are some right-wing political elements and some kind of Euroscepticism, anti-Europeanism that's growing in the ranks. And I know a lot of England national team supporters are in that kind of mold, and they don't support clubs. They're not going to Manchester United or Liverpool games. In fact, the fan base of Liverpool in particular, a lot of them don't root for England, right? They root for the Republic of Ireland, or just watch international tournaments and root for their players. They're rooting for Coutinho in Brazil and rooting for whoever else, you know.
Adam Bogdan, yeah.
Yeah, rooting for Origi and their Belgian players. That sort of thing. So there is a different element of person who supports the England national team than the club teams a lot of Americans that are listening to the show think about in the Premier League. Don't automatically take it like the U.S. where everybody gets behind the national team and there's, we all come together, all MLS and NASL clubs and USL clubs, were all US men's national team fans. It's not like that. There's an element of fans who don't root for clubs or root for non-league clubs or League One, League Two clubs that are England fans. And then there are a lot of fans who are in England who support bigger clubs, or actually think back to the 1980s and say, I don't want to support England. England is there's a hooligan element. So you have these two things put in a mixer. I'm very sympathetic with England's pleas and the fact that it seems like the European press and UEFA and people in Europe like to consistently blame the English for these problems unfairly. That having been said, there are a lot of things that the English supporters brought on themselves, the segment of English supporters that were fighting, the segment that don't have tickets and showed up in Marseille, the segment that were singing anti-IRA songs outside of Irish pubs looking for fights. They're not blameless in all of this. What happened in the stadium, obviously the Russian supporters attacked them with apparently the encouragement of the Russian FA and potentially the sports minister in Putin's government. Long story short, this is a bad scene. Russia, I think, should have been tossed out of this tournament. They weren't. I think England should be on a zero tolerance policy. And if there are any problems, they should be taught any more problems. They should be tossed out. I do give Greg Dyke credit for having Roy Hodgson and Wayne Rooney cut a video basically saying if you're ticketless, don't go. If you don't have tickets, don't come to Lille. And if you do have tickets, behave yourself. Yeah. That was a courageous move. But I think England is under the cosh and could get thrown out of this tournament. And if they get thrown out of it, they did it to themselves. And it's tough for the players. But this is something that we cannot have in football. In this day, football was not a global phenomenon like this in the 1980s when we had all of these hooligan problems. And this is a threat to the sport continuing its march to where it unites people around the world. It will become once again tribal, divide people and turn people off. And I'll just finish on this. In the 1980s, snooker was more popular on British television than football, believe it or not, because the hooligan element in England and in Wales and Cardiff City hooligans, but you know, between England and Wales had turned off so many fans of so many people to be part of the sport. The comeback came after football united, the Hillsborough tragedy, which had nothing to do with hooliganism, and I'm glad the court has finally confirmed that. The world of football came back together, and English football is now this beautiful, lovely thing that the world loves. It's the world's game. It's played in England and Wales, but it's the world's game. This is a threat to it, so it needs to be stamped out.
Yeah. Ronnie O'Sullivan, who's a big-time fan of the Eurocopa podcast, will be listening and will be happy to hear that you name-dropped snooker, which is a first for the Eurocopa podcast. Gabe, the thing I want to ask you is really quickly, because we got to move on.
Yeah, sure.
There's another facet to this that in Karthik's elegant response, he might not have touched on. And that's the fact that with the way things are in Europe, with the terrorist attacks and things like that, there's a hypervigilance within the governing bodies and the police as well. So I think I'm not blaming the police, but that is another thing that contributed, I think, to some of this fan violence is probably the, or maybe exacerbated the problem, I guess is a better way to put it, was the egregious use of tear gas a little bit of police brutality even.
Yeah. I'm glad you brought it up. I think it's, you know, it's interesting, you know, kind of perspective to come from. I mean, obviously you kind of see now almost the militarization of police forces, of city police forces, as prepare for circumstances that you only think that military would have to deal with. And so that's not something that's unique then to France or United States. It's, you know, it's happening all over the world. Getting in beyond that, I do think that you certainly look at to where there's been this element of kind of, you know, fanning the flames at times. But I also, you know, take a step back and look at it in terms of the way you were kind of characterizing that question to Karthik and the way he was answering and addressing is kind of how can some of these things come about? I think even in some element, you have to look at, too, just where the focus was, right? Going into this tournament, the biggest concern was of an international, you know, of a terrorist
incident. Islamic terrorism, essentially.
That was going to take place. And so you have to think that at the forefront of every then French official's mindset going in preparations and security protocols for this tournament was thinking about that. And so you have then this focus then completely into then, you know, how you're patting down, you know, what kind of items are being let in, you know, how are you able to ensure that even these just big pools of people that are standing around in terms of kind of watching parties, these outside TV areas, how can we keep them safe, right? Mm-hmm. But it was always towards then that element of someone bringing a bomb, something like that. It was not then, again, this kind of of return than of hooliganism. This idea that you were going to have, Jordan from Brighton and Yuri from St. Petersburg that were going to have a testosterone test, right? You know, right there in the streets. And so I certainly have quite a bit of sympathy for the type of situations right now that French police and other officials have been put in through there. But, you know, we can certainly say that there could be things that could have been handled better. We're obviously seeing now some reactions towards what's taking place. I think that they've done a good job of trying to stamp this out, the kind of threats that have been placed towards them, you know, Russia and England. We've already heard then again in terms of alcohol bans taking place. So they're certainly not taking this lightly, and I appreciate doing so. But it is, I got to say, it's got to be, you know, quite the difficult task right now, trying to quell this kind of fan violence. And I shouldn't even use the word fan, because they're right. Karthik's right. They're not fans. They're not really supporters of these teams. When you have then such a security concern leading into the tournament, obviously then with some of the terrorist incidents that have taken place in Europe. Yeah.
Karthik, let's move ahead to actually talking about some football now. Some few talking points. We're not going to go through the groups per se, but teams that we tend to focus on. England, the only game we watched was the England-Russia game. Beyond the fan madness, we saw some good things on the pitch from England, and then some of the old school England letting go of leads and capitulating. So is this England team, by the way, let me add, a Vardy-less England team, Vardy was not played in this game, is this team in the danger of falling into the same way as the last, I don't know, 20 years of English teams?
Well, they're not going to be as bad as the team in the last World Cup, so that's the first thing. They'll be better than that. Not that that's saying much. England was one of the worst teams in the tournament. I know our colleague Christopher Harris, the gaffer, thinks England was the single worst team in the 2014 World Cup. I'd say they were the second worst. Honduras was slightly worse.
Spain was okay, too.
Spain was, yeah, right. but of course, you could point to moments as we have with Spain, the Holland game, where it went bad for them. But sure. This game, I felt like... I saw what Hodgson was trying. I just don't think the execution from Lallana and from Sterling were good enough. I think the other issue with playing Sterling and Lallana is you weren't getting, because of the way they play, you weren't getting the kind of overlapping runs from Danny Rose and from Kyle Walker that you need to really create dangerous chances in the area. Yes, England had a lot of possession. They had a lot of half chances. They were clearly the better side in this game, but they didn't create enough chances, and ultimately they scored on a free kick. Create enough good chances, I should say. Mm-hmm. I really want to see Daniel Sturridge play on against Wales from an England perspective. We'll talk about Wales in a couple minutes. I want to see Sturridge in that game. I don't know that Vardy is the answer. I think Sturridge is probably that guy, that X factor. If you put Sturridge in a mixture with Rooney, I think some wonderful things will happen. And I have to say this because there's so much criticism, unfounded criticism of Wayne Rooney. He's the last holdover from this these England fans, and I once again talk about a lot of the England fans not being club fans, not being fans of big clubs, not watching the Premier League week in and week out. We talked about that with the hooliganism. They have chosen certain individuals, Frank Lampard, Steven Gerrard, and Wayne Rooney to pick on and to take out all their frustrations on and to say, well, this is why England has failed. Wayne Rooney showed on Saturday that he's still a world-class player, that you can put him anywhere on the pitch and he will be the single best player on that pitch. You can play him deep as a deep-lying midfielder and he will pick out a pass. He will control the tempo of a game. England fans that then complain about Rooney, which they continued to do after this game, to me, don't understand the game. And I'm very happy for Wayne Rooney that there are some people who now see his value and realize why Roy Hodgson has kept him in the squad. You keep reading this stuff all, well, Rooney's been terrible for Manchester United. You have to play Vardy. You have to play this one who had a good season. That one had a good season. Wayne Rooney is still a cut above every English player. I think there was a big mistake not taking Michael Carrick to this tournament, but you got to drop Rooney into that role then to kind of dictate the tempo and keep the ball moving the way Carrick would. And obviously, I think it's a mistake not to take Drinkwater. That's a whole nother issue, but I'm very happy for Wayne Rooney, and I think this could be his tournament. He could define his legacy. England's not going to win this tournament, but the way he played against Russia, he's going to continue to play at that level, and there's no goal-scoring pressure on him like there have been in previous international tournaments, and he's fit. I think this could be a defining moment. We'll think about, remember that last big international tournament for Rooney, the Euro 2016, when England got to, let's say, the quarterfinals, but he really was one of the best players in the tournament. I'm hoping we have that conversation
so
now.
I have to say that since we're short on time, I won't elaborate on this too much, but I actually disagree with Karthik, and I'm more in the in line with the people who are critical of Wayne Rooney. Maybe it's because I'm a self-hating Man United supporter, but I see a lot of merit in what the argument has been made, because when I see Wayne Rooney play, I think he catches the eye as a central midfielder when he plays a 50-yard pass, which, to be honest, he's as good as the best out there when it comes to long-range passing. But what he's not doing well for me is the simpler stuff in central midfield. It's a simpler pass. It's a short pass to the wing. It's a short pass to the forward, trying to link up the play. And those are the things that are very important as a holding midfielder. So to me, I don't think... Exactly. I completely agree with you there. There's no disagreement. I think that was a huge mistake to not bring Drinkwater and Carrick. But I think given the personnel they have right now... I still think Wayne Rooney is a terrific player. I just think if England are to be taken seriously, they cannot expect a player to turn into a central midfielder overnight, the way Louis van Gaal did. Because you can't one day decide that he's a number nine, and then 2 weeks later, because you have another number nine in Martial and Rashford, decide, oh, big deal, Wayne Rooney will play central midfield. Football is more complicated than that, and I don't think a player of even Wayne Rooney's ability, arguably the best English player since Gascoigne or maybe Bobby Charlton, is able to make that switch that quickly at the world stage. Okay, moving away from England, Gabe, Spain. Problem with Spain, we talked about in the previews, no Diego Costa, goal scoring is a problem. But then when you have Andres Iniesta... And then basically you have likes of Andres and Iniesta and all those brilliant midfielders. You essentially end up getting a goal from Gerard Piqué. So, I mean, we're not still sold on Spain. Some of those issues are still there. But a heartening win for what has been a very informed Spanish team.
Yeah, I think you look at Spain and you still think back to the dominance that they had. And you still want to believe that that team is still in there at some point. And there's obviously elements of it. I think Iniesta is obviously a big piece of this right now, and kind of holding the fort together for Spain. But the dynamic though is it just really isn't there as much anymore. I think you look at a player like Cesc Fabregas who. At times seemed to be, out of position, just didn't really seem to go with the flow. All that said, then he, makes then, a saving clearance there that obviously then, keeps Spain 3 points. You see then a defense that in terms of individual names is brilliant, but, sometimes there's been question marks in terms of Piqué and Ramos, with that chemistry in terms of building that. But I think that the elephant in the room is certainly then their number nine position. It's been something that they've been weak in. Obviously, during they were playing a false nine at that point. They were able to get kind of past that weakness, play around it. Now it just kind of seems to be a bit more glaring. I like and all that said, I like Morata. I think he's a great player. Didn't have maybe necessarily the best of years with Juventus. Just in terms of coming off the bench quite a bit. Wasn't a guaranteed start every time, and I just don't think that he's a player right now going into this tournament. When strikers won the. Most key elements to a striker is that confidence. I just don't think he's got that right now at this point in time to really take Spain over the edge. So I think the question marks are still there. And then you throw in then the De Gea saga, kind of going into this tournament.
All right, yeah, we didn't even talk about that. Yeah.
I'm a bit surprised that honestly Spain didn't maybe lose this one against Czech Republic in that initial match, just with all those kind of factors going on there. So
were you guys surprised De Gea started? Because I was after all of that.
I was a little bit with the lead up, but Nipun, I definitely want to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, so my thoughts on that are that De Gea has shown that he is able to compartmentalize off field stuff. And the perfect example was during the Real Madrid saga, except for when he was dropped by Van Gaal, which was Van Gaal being stupid as opposed to De Gea, even before that, he didn't show any signs of dissent. Didn't show any signs of dropping form, and was able to show that he is able to separate what's going on. So I think that's why he started, and I think there's a So first of all, I should say, as I tweeted, that it's okay for us to say we'll wait until the facts come out before mm-hmm. we pass judgment on De Gea.
Sure.
So yeah. I think there's a, having said that, there's a firm belief in the Spain camp and De Gea's camp that he will be found innocent. So I think that's why the Spanish team stood by him, and I think that's why he started. So yeah, that was a good point, Gabe. I actually didn't even think about that, but that was a huge talking point before the game kicked off. Gabe, yeah. Sorry, Karthik, let's talk about the Republic of Ireland game against Sweden. Not specifically about the game, I guess, but you and I talked about the fact that both of us felt Republic of Ireland would finish above Sweden in this group, which is the group of death. And this game, I was impressed by how well Republic of Ireland played. I thought Robbie Brady was terrific. I thought they looked good in defense. And had it not been for another brilliant Ibra moment, this game could have honestly finished 2-3 for Republic of Ireland, I thought.
Yeah, they didn't take the chances in the first half. I think Robbie Brady in the first round of games, you could argue, had the second best performance by any Premier League player. Mm-hmm, the best, of course, being Dimitri Payet, who was off, might be the best player of this tournament so far. For the host nation, of course, for France. I thought Brady was fantastic. Roberto Martinez tipped it at halftime on our broadcast here in the United States. The former Everton manager, who I criticized a lot as a manager. He's one of the best commentators out there. Nailed it again.
I've never heard you criticize Roberto Martinez.
Roberto Martinez nailed it again. He's been right about everything that he's talked about during this tournament. He said, I think Ireland need to get Wes Houlihan more touches.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, okay, that's just a basic piece of analysis. 3 minutes later, Houlihan, first touch. Brilliant goal.
Yeah.
First touch of the second half. So Martinez nailed that, but Houlihan was good. I felt like the one guy I was disappointed with was Shane Long. You know how quick he is, what a counterattacking mm-hmm. threat he is, and how slow that back line of Sweden is. Martin O'Neill was trying to get him in different positions to run onto balls, lob balls in his direction, and he was very fragile. I wonder if Robbie Keane is fully fit if you go with Robbie Keane in the game against Belgium. Mm-hmm. That's a consideration. So, but very good performance from the Republic of Ireland.
They also have Jonathan Walters, who played fairly well in this game.
Walters was excellent in this game. I mean, I could go through the whole Ireland squad. We both could, and we pick out everybody who was good. There's a lot of criticism of Kieran Clark because of the own goal and why is he playing when he didn't play much at Villa this year. But I thought he had a good game until that moment.
Yeah. Same with Seamus Coleman, who was kind of guilty for the Ibra run, but had a good game otherwise.
Yeah, and Darren Randolph was very good in goal. That was a bit of a controversial decision. Martin O'Neill had made that decision a while ago to switch to Randolph, but Randolph doesn't play regularly for West mm-hmm. Ham, right? He plays in cup games. But I thought he was very good. He had a very, very good game. So there's not much to complain about other than the result. Unfortunately, the result puts Ireland in a position where might not get out of this group. And I was thinking there was a very good chance of being one of the best third place teams coming in.
Yeah. Gabe, I'm glad we have you for this. Let's talk about your beloved Belgium. We didn't get to have
you on. How do you know it's going?
Yeah. We didn't get to have you on when we previewed Belgium's groups as the rotation turned out. But I mean, this was a good game to watch, first of all, but a poor performance from Belgium, a poor performance from the forwards, a poor performance from the midfield. I thought in general, Belgium is... Okay, so the Belgium team are the Red Devils, much like Man United. And every time I watch Belgium play, if Fellaini's not putting away goals, no one's putting away goals. So tell me how you rate this your beloved Belgium side right now.
Well, so I think that there's definitely enough talent on this team to where, I put them essentially in that, in that kind of, threshold, right below the Germany and the France. I mean, there's, again, on paper, there's enough talented players in the squad. There's enough to tinker with here. I think the problem is the person doing the tinkering. I've never been a big fan of Wilmots. I think that what we saw in that match then kind of highlights some of my personal issues with him. I think Conte, masterclass effort there in terms of what he was able to do then against Wilmots. And you didn't really see much flexibility there at all going in from from halftime in the second half. I was kind of expecting some changes. You brought up then the Fellaini point. I think that the problem is it's not necessarily a disservice to Fellaini, who did overall pretty well, because it almost seems to where when he's in the match, especially playing a number 10 position, that the entire style of play completely alters, right? Mm-hmm. He becomes a focal point.
Absolutely.
You start then having it to where he's going to knock down balls. You're going to have then overlapping runs from midfielders. Not necessarily though the best tactic when Italy is congesting the entire center of the pitch. Mm-hmm. I mean, like I said, masterclass effort there. You saw to where Belgium routinely was either having to completely backtrack, pass it backwards, reset, or moving it around from side to side there, trying to find some kind of inlet in the middle, and the entire midfield there was completely congested by Italian players. It was a great effort there. I think that overall, when you look at it, Belgium in terms of it, again, that dynamic that they had there was wrong. I would have liked to either have seen, you know, Hazard or De Bruyne then play in the middle, get then a more natural winger, and Mertens then out on the wings. You had some width. You had opportunities to play there. I think the dynamic going against then a three center back system in Italy is you want to try to draw one of those then outside center backs out, right? And the width was there. Bring something back in, but there was really no attempts there. And again, once Belgium started making any kind of inroads there, lose possession, Italy going on the counter there, or if you did have Belgium then that was playing, you know, deep back, especially in the second half there at times, trying to get something, anything, and play a counterattack of their own, you had some very, very, very smart fouls there from Italy that broke up any kind of counterattack that was possible. They just literally frustrated Belgium throughout the entire match. You could see it on the faces there. You could even get it some of the reactions. Courtois was one that kind of seemed like we weren't sure if he was taking a shot at Wilmots or if he was congratulating his soon-to-be manager there in Conte. But mm-hmm. but you could tell the frustration. I even saw some Vincent Kompany quotes. This is a Belgian team that, you know, they're not used to having such high expectations going into a tournament. And so this was really kind of the first opportunity to see how they were going to be able to handle those expectations. And thus far, we've gotten certainly a pretty good indication that they have a lot to improve on.
Yeah. Just a couple of real quick points on this. I think, one, even though he didn't play much for Spurs towards the end of the season, Nasser Chadli, big miss. It's a guy that you could have brought in this game, along with Dries Mertens, who, I said in our preview pod, I thought would be a key player for Belgium, and I was stunned when he didn't start. And you saw the impact he made when he came off the bench. So I think I would have brought Chadli. I also think you're going to have to get some sort of solution to the Hazard trying to take on five guys and pinching inside,
right,
and De Bruyne pinching inside, because you've got no width. You're just playing into the middle, and it's going to be very easily. Look, Martin O'Neill, we've watched him for years in the Premier League at Leicester and Aston Villa, the way he sets up his teams, which is to defend well, and with Shane Long as your counterattacking threat, right? He now has it at the Republic of Ireland. Belgium could be walking into the same sort of coal mine, so to speak, trap in this game if they don't figure out, they don't get some width. Chadli not being on the team hurts. I also think that maybe you want to find a role for Moussa Dembele in this match. All the width in this game were coming from Simone, who of course plays in Major League Soccer, at right back, and then Vertonghen playing left back in a position he was not comfortable with. And he's another player that showed a lot of frustration toward the end of that match with his teammates. So I'm hoping it just doesn't blow up, because a lot of us want to see Belgium potentially win this tournament, an outsider country win it, but early returns are not good.
No. Yeah, I, from my perspective, I can't help but feel that as the manager, Wilmots really has to somehow convince his players that positions actually matter, because his players are running around in free roles that they should have no business taking up. And, you know, the counterpoint to that is when you have such great attacking players, you'll let them do whatever they want. But that's just not the case, especially at an international tournament. You look at Argentina. The reason they've had that success is because there's one player who's given free role. That's Messi, because he's one of the two best players in the world. Angel Di Maria, even Angel Di Maria, who I think is one of the five best players in the world, does not have a free role. And that's what you need to do as a manager, is tell them, hey, it's okay if one of you has a free role, say Eden Hazard does. But De Bruyne, yeah, you can't go wherever the hell you want either. Lukaku, you can't go to the left side when I want you to play centrally. Fellaini, you can't be in central midfield when I want you just behind the striker. So there has to be some reining in of that team, and there is none right now. Gentlemen, last thing we'll talk about is, oh, by the way, we'll skip Italy because I think Gabe said what we needed to, which is that Conte essentially destroyed Belgium by himself.
One really just ironic point about Italy, Giaccarini is a Sunderland castoff. He's on loan, right? He was loaned to Bologna this year. Graziano Pella plays for Southampton, never fancied by any of the bigger Premier League squads. These are the two guys who scored goals against a team full of Premier League stars. I mean, you name it, like a Premier League ideal best 11, half of them are Belgian. So it's just half or more. I mean, you could put together like an all-star team of just Belgian players in the Premier League. I mean, to me, that's very ironic, and that speaks again, Wilmots versus Conte, Belgium's mentality versus Italy's mentality. Yeah.
And you can't give enough credit to Chiellini, who was there every time Fellaini went in for a header. So massive credit to that defense. Gabe, let's talk about the game here. With last thing we'll talk about is the amazing win. The amazing result for Iceland against Portugal. Iceland, this is the best statistic, I think, of the tournament. 300,000 people population, a tenth of them are in France right now for the Euros. Amazing, amazing statistic. A tenth of the population is there. And someone actually, I forgot the stat, but pulled up a stat of how much of the population is actually in the playing 11. It's like 10,000 or something. Hilarious. Or
that Cristiano Ronaldo has like 500,000 more, or 500 times as many Twitter followers
than the population of Iceland.
The population. Yeah. That was the best one of all.
What I want to say, everyone, including Cristiano, is talking about the failings of Portugal, but we need to give some credit to this Iceland team, a team that comprises mostly of players who are playing in Sweden and Norway, and of course some players that we know in the Premier League like Sigurdsson and someone like of that ilk. So, but in general, talk to me about this Iceland team. I can't say enough about what an amazing result this 1-1 draw is.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's quite impressive. I think, you know, honestly, you know, going into this tournament, I was a bit, you know, worried about the saturation of the group stages there with the increase, you know, from 16 to 24 teams. You know, what was that going to put in terms of the dynamic there of those group stage games? What are we going to see then from a team like Iceland or a team like Hungary? And what we've seen is actually been quite impressive in the sense of, you know, they aren't what we were talking about earlier about, you know, Haiti kind of getting intimidated by the Brazilian shirts, right? These nations right now not necessarily getting intimidated by the moment. And so I've been quite pleased to see that. I mean, we haven't really seen in terms of, you know, any of the games or the goal differential. Biggest has been two goals. It's been great from that perspective. I think that, you know, Iceland certainly obviously came into this match with a game plan. Going to be playing, you know, free flowing attacking football. They knew that they were going to have to pick their chances. I think they might have had just like two created chances out through the entire match there. But that's all they needed, right? In terms of getting that goal. Now that being said, it's been quite interesting, obviously, to hear then Ronaldo's viewpoints from that as he was
so quite stupid.
Quite critical then of that and saying parking the bus, you know, in the net itself, not even going out to play. But again, I mean, in terms of the resources, the lack of resources there for Iceland, I'm not sure what he was technically expecting going this. And if anything, obviously it's just a greater show in terms of what Portugal should have known coming into this match and in how the setup was going to be and how they needed to play. So I'm not sure why they're so shocked in that regard, or maybe it's just Ronaldo being Ronaldo, you know, to a certain point. But yeah, you have to love these kind of moments. It's some of those things to where you get that kind of underdog type performance, even with it being a draw at this point. You know, it's so something gratifying that a lot of these players are going to be able to remember. You know, the day that they played Portugal and do a draw, or again, you know, in terms of you know, playing against you know, a caliber of a player like Ronaldo. So just a great feel good story for sure.
Yeah, I think Cristiano, you know, just forgets the first season against Mourinho, the way they played against Barcelona. He forgets a couple of games under even Sir Alex in that 2008 season, the Champions League winning season, where United went, you know, won that championship based on defense as opposed to anything he was doing because he was crap for half of that season. So, Karthik, let's talk about Portugal real quick. Obviously, we talked about Cristiano, but I've mentioned that I personally think that defense has some problems in it, and for the goal in particular, and also a couple of other chances that ended up being fouls, Portugal's defense looked kind of shaky to me.
Yeah, they did. Although I have to say, if you take prior to the goal, Portugal looked like one of the better teams in the tournament. Prior to Iceland's goals, goal, the first 50-55 minutes of the game, I think Portugal you would put up there with Italy, Germany, maybe Spain, is really kind of the teams that had stood out from the early from the first set of games in the group stage. And then, you know, you, there's this old adage, right? A goal can change a game. Another little bit of analysis I'm starting from stealing from the former Everton manager Roberto Martinez. He said he's seen very few games where a goal has completely changed a game like this, because Iceland looked like they were tired, they were on the back foot. It seemed like Portugal was going to get the three or four in the second half, and then this goal happened, and then we saw kind of the shakiness of that Portugal back line, the chippiness of players like Pepe, and quite frankly, the kind of sloping shoulders and body language, and Cristiano feeling like he had to do more than take things on. First half, he's drawing defenders away from other attacking players like Eder and Nani, who are then getting opportunities to score goals, opportunities to dictate play themselves. Second half, he's then back in that mode, I have to do it myself, I've got to win this game. And that was what really stood out for me. Not that, and it's great that Iceland got the point, and I think we're all happy for Iceland tonight. The thing that stood out to me was Portugal played very well for 55 minutes. You wonder how they're going to respond to adversity, because Portugal is a country like England, although they've been better than England, but, you know, a country like that that has not been winning tournaments, but people feel like they should be. So I thought, okay, this bit of adversity, how are they going to bounce back from this? How are they going to react? I want to see what happens now that Iceland got this improbable goal completely against the run of play. And it was bad. It was the old Portugal. And the same Portugal we saw when things began to go wrong in the semifinal in this tournament the last time, and they lost on penalty kicks to Spain. The same Portugal we saw frustrated against the Czech Republic in that same tournament. The same Portugal we saw in the game against the United States, where they got the late goal, but they let the U.S. basically take it to them in the second half. So I'm concerned about them, and you make a good point about their back line. That having been said, just don't forget the first 55 minutes. They looked really good. They looked like they could win this tournament in that first 55 minutes.
That's good. That's why we consider you to be the one with a balanced analysis, while Gabe and I just ramble stuff off. So
and throw stuff at each other, for sure.
Exactly, and throw chairs at each other. So, gentlemen, we'll be back later this week to talk more footy with each other, and we'll probably come back after a couple of the definitely after the U.S. men's national team game, the quarterfinal against Ecuador, which I hope the U.S. will win, and then we'll come back on the weekend as well, and then get back to at least a weekly podcast format. Until we do that, on behalf of everyone at World Soccer Talk and Eurocopa Podcast, I'm your host Nipun Chopra. Thank you for joining us. On behalf of Gabe Smith, Karthik Krishnayar,
unless you're Dunga, you're enjoying your football tonight.